All right, so as we turn our attention to Nehemiah chapter 10, we just want to catch up with where we're at. Of course, Nehemiah has come back to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls. They have accomplished that in a record, 52 days. And but now we're seeing this period afterwards of what we're calling revival, because we see in chapter 8, they read the word of the Lord, and it hasn't been read, and the people, first they started crying, remember? And then they said, no, this is a time not for grieving, but for joy, because we're returning to the word. We're connecting back with our Father, and so we can understand what his covenant's all about so we can obey it. So that was in chapter 8, reading the law, chapter 8. And then chapter 9, here is a time for grieving, because it opens in chapter 9 and verse 1. They sat with sackcloth and ashes and they're fasting because they're mourning, because what did they learn when they were reading the law all those days? Yeah, we haven't been keeping God's law, because you can't keep what you don't know, and they didn't know it. And then they also realized why they were sent to Babylonian imprisonment, right? They realize it's because we have been forsaking God. We haven't been keeping his law. And we were wondering if he had forsaken us. And now they realize, no, we're the ones that were unfaithful. So chapter 9 is this wonderful prayer that rehearses the history of Israel. How God was faithful, but Israel was unfaithful. But we cried, and you heard. And then things were good for a while, but then we just went off the deep end again. And then when enemies came in, we cried and you heard. Three times it says that. So it said, we confess our sins before you. Yes.
So they're having this revival now, but is this sort of them going, is it later than going overboard that sets the standard for the traditions of men that we see in the first century?
Right.
They go overboard and trying to keep the commandments?
That's a good question. And he says, did they, in their zeal to get back to the law and not be unfaithful and get taken back to captivity, did they go too far in keeping some of these laws and writing things and demanding things that God never commanded himself? We'll suggest yes. And there's going to be an example, hopefully, of it today that we get to. All right? Okay? But so this confession, if you want to get back to God, and you want to get spiritually reinvigorated, if you want relationships better, if you want your life better, whatever, it's going to start, first of all, get to know God's word. You got to know what he wants you to do, because his mind has to become your mind. And the reason we get in trouble, because we weren't following him, we were the Lord of our own life. But when you do that, you got to identify what you've done wrong, and be humble about it and repent and confess. There's something very healthy about confessing. Because when you're not confessing, what are you doing? Holding it in and denying. You're living as though it's not that bad. And everyone else does it. It really doesn't matter. No, no, no. Or I didn't do it. Confessing is so healthy. And you have to find the right people to confess to personally, but we can always confess to God. It's so important to start over. You got to clear out, right? Now we're going to see in chapter 10, there's this covenant. And so look with me at the end of chapter 9, at the end of that prayer. And remember, last week we spent all that time reading the prayer. Now, verse 38, we see just this single verse that describes what they are going to do in response to their acknowledgement that they have been wrong and unfaithful. Now, because of all this, now that refers backwards, right? The reading the law and all the confessing. We're making agreement in writing on the sealed document are the names of our leaders, the Levites, and our priests. An agreement in writing. Now, I think I have it up here. This people's covenant is what we're going to talk about. The ESV says we're going to make a firm covenant in writing. A binding agreement. The King James has covenant. So agreement in writing is not just agreement. It's much stronger than that. This is a covenant. All right? Now, that harkens all the way back to the language when God brought Israel out of Egyptian captivity, took them to Mount Sinai, and said, if you obey my words, you will be a nation, a priest to me, a kingdom, a holy nation, a kingdom of priests, you know, a people for my own possession. And what did the people say? All the Lord has said, we'll do. Well, we'll find out if they did. And then he spoke the Ten Commandments. Moses received the rest. When he came down, he spoke all the commandments to the people. What'd they say? All the Lord has said, we will do. And then he makes an altar, has sacrifices, writes it all in a book then. And then he reads the book out loud to the people. And what do they say for the third time? All the Lord has said, we will do. Then he sprinkles blood on the book, on the altar, on the people, and they enter into a covenant relationship with God, and they're going, that's what we're going to do. If God said we're going to do it, we're going to do it. All right? A covenant. Now, when you make a covenant, it's a binding oath before God. All right? It's very, very serious. Yes?
Jack, is this reference to the sealed document? Is that like a signet ring? Like we read a king sealing a document with their authority?
I would guess so. They would put some type of mark to show that, yes, this is our signatures, our names are on it. And I think that's very important you point that out. They write it down, and each one puts their sign on it. I'm down. I'm all in. So you can't go back, well, I didn't sign that thing. No, there's... All these heads of the families are going to be involved in this commitment. Yes?
Very loosely, but it's sort of similar to the people signing the Declaration of Independence.
Yes. Right. And who is the one that said, well, certainly if we don't overcome, we'll
hang together, we'll all hang separately.
How does it say that?
If we don't all hang together, we'll all hang separately.
Yeah, if we don't hang together, we'll all hang separately. Right, because... We have to do it as a compact, right? Yes.
At the end of verse 38, New King James says, and our leaders, our Levites, and our priests seal it.
Seal it.
After they made the covenant and wrote this out in writing,
yeah, there's
the
seal.
This would be the next level for them to seal it because they were responsible for the word.
Yes. Clinton.
All the things which are revealed, we will do. But the things that are not revealed belong to us.
All right. That's right. All right, so here is my application. If there's something in your life you're wrestling with, you're going to have to first acknowledge that you're wrestling with it, and it's causing you to fall short of God. And you have to be dishonest about it. And no more beating around the bush, giving excuses, you know, blaming life events. You just come to terms, I'm responsible. I have failed. God's been faithful. It hasn't been him, it's been me. And then you have to make a decision to make a covenant or an oath. Because I found like in my life, the reason that some things that I always keep wrestling with and going back to is because I hadn't made a promise to God that I'm done. So I might say, well, I quit. You know, I'm not going to do this anymore. But there's something short, different promising yourself or just saying that and making an oath to God. And if you don't know what I mean, just examine your life and say, have you ever promised to God and gave an oath, I am not going to do this anymore, or I'm going to start doing this, right? That's what they're doing here. We're going to obey you, and we're putting our name down in an oath. And when you make that covenant to God, all of a sudden it becomes easier to do it. People have sometimes asked, how do you make it to service every Sunday? Because some people really struggle with that decision on Sunday morning if they should get up and go. You know why it's difficult? Because you're waiting till Sunday morning to make that decision. You make the decision today for the rest of your life, and you make an oath to God, I will be there to honor you if I'm healthy enough and it's within my ability and I have the opportunity. I'll be there. And so when you make that and you're serious about it, it's easy to go. That's just what you do. You made a promise to God, and he's worthy. And you don't look back. And all of a sudden, that's easy. And it's true with every other aspect of your life. They made a covenant. They wrote it down. Yes?
Job talks in look up on a young maiden.
Yeah, not to look on a virgin, right? Yeah, covenant with his eyes. So there is where they are. And I have to tell the story. I came across this when I was preparing all this. This guy had just poured this fresh concrete. And he went in to get some lemonade. He looks up, and here's this little boy. This is a picture of a girl, but, and you know, princess, yeah. And walking right through the fresh concrete. So he goes out there, "What are you doing, kid? Get out of here," and runs him off. And he comes back in, and his wife says, "I thought you loved little boys." He says, "Well, I love them in abstract, but I don't love them in concrete." I go, "That's funny. And what's the application?" A lot of people love Christianity. They like talking about it. They like studying the Bible. They like the drama and the love and just the emotions. But if you get too close to asking them to make a change in their life, now it's too concrete. It's gone from the abstract to the practical, and they don't want to, right? They like the idea, but they don't want to make the change. And we're like, does that make sense what we're trying to say? And once you decide to make the change, Christianity becomes a joy. It's not a burden. It's a pleasure. That's the way it's supposed to be. "Come ye all who are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest." So there's where we are. And so Charles Spurgeon wrote this, and I just want to read a little bit of it. "I have found in my own spiritual life that more rules I lay down for myself, the more sins I commit." That's interesting. The more rules I lay down, the more sins I commit. What do you think he means by that? Have you ever experienced that? When you say, "I'm not going to do this," or "I'm going to do this, I'm going to get up and pray every morning for 5 minutes, how long before you break that? "Or I'm going to read the Bible every night for an hour before I go to bed for the rest of my life." You ever done anything like that? Yeah, the first time you get sick, or some first time the kids are sick, and you're up, and you just start to read, and you fall asleep, and it's only been 15 minutes. So we've got to be careful about making covenants. "I'm going to do this." No, the more you commit to, he's what he's saying, "I'm going to be this perfect person," the more you end up disappointing yourself. So I'm not suggesting you go around and start, like this, just making rules for all your life. "I demand all this myself, and if I don't, I'm a failure, and I got to do everything perfectly." Because guess what? You won't. But can you make some general oaths to God about your service and dedication to him? Yes. Can you? All right. Notice here. "To say I will humble myself at such a time," he's talking about prayer, "and rejoice at such another season is merely as much as affection as when the preacher wrote in the margin of his sermon, 'Cry here,' or 'Smile here.'" You know what I'm saying? If you demand certain things of yourself that don't come from within, it's like a preacher. He's got his notes and he has a little side thing. Tell joke here or cry. Show a tear. And some preachers I've seen, they have that, you know, laugh here. And what does it all come across as? Canned and artificial. And he says, you can't do that. So if this man preached from his heart, he would be assured to cry in the right place, wouldn't he? And he would smile at the suitable moment. And that's the same thing you got to do with your life. When you're moved to say, "I'm done with this. I'm sick and tired of this," make a promise to God, no more, right? It's got to be genuine and from within. That's where revival starts. Kevin. Oh, someone. Oh.
Yeah, I was just going to add with regards to that, making any kind of a commitment to change and not living up to that. Prayer is first and foremost in all of that, because God will help to direct that path. If you continue to pray to him about it, if you struggle with anything, whether it's anxiety, worry, whatever,
right,
you pray.
Right.
And God will then intercede, and he will help you through those.
Oh, yeah. Heal him. Because if you made that promise, he knows you're serious. He's going to help you.
Yes.
Right. Okay, chapter 10 then, verse 1. And if you look through verse 27, now we have a list of names. What we're going to have is the signers of this document. So verse 1, now on the sealed document were the names of, and it's going to list them, Nehemiah the governor. That's who it starts with. And Zedekiah, some suggest that might have been his assistant. Then it's going to give verse 2 all the way through 8. These were the priests. So verse 2 through 8 are the priests. Verse 9, now the Levites. And so they're all the way down to verse 13. And then verse 14, it says the leaders of the people, Perush, put all the way down through 27. See that? And so when we look at this, and we look at this list of the signers of the covenant, there's going to be three groups here. We're going to see Nehemiah and Zedekiah, the 21 priests and the heads of all the priestly households, the names of the 17 heads of Levitical households, then 44 heads of the leading families. And now some of these names were given to us in Ezra 2 and that other list in Nehemiah. Some are new names, so maybe they've come from Babylon since then. But these represent all the families that are in Jerusalem right now. So is this a unified, universal commitment to go back to God by all of Israel that's living in that area? Yes. That's what it's going to take if a church is going to rise up. It takes everyone to be committed. Everyone. And it starts with what? The leaders down. The governor to the priests, the Levites, then the families. It starts from the top down. And I'll have something to say about it in a second. So, now notice in verse 28 then. That's not correct. I think that's wrong. Yeah, it is verse 28. That baby's got lungs. Now the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the temple servants, and all those who had, here it is, separated themselves from the people of the lands to the law of their God, their wives and their sons and daughters, all those who had knowledge and understanding, are joining with their kinsmen, their nobles, and are taking an oath themselves, a curse, and an oath to walk in God's law, which was given through Moses, God's servant, and to keep and to observe all the commandments of the God our Lord, and his ordinances and his statutes. And then we will not, okay, I'll stop right there. So notice here what happens. It says that the people, they make an oath, but they separated themselves from the people of the lands. What were they referring to? Someone help me in the back. What's that referring to? I'm sorry? All right, so what does it mean they separated themselves from it? Pushed them away? Yes? I'm saying again? Sanctified themselves? All right. Go ahead, Brad.
Hey, when I think it was Ezra first came back, he saw that a lot of the Jews had intermarried.
They'd intermarried.
It was against God's law, and this was those who had put those Jewish spouses away.
When we go back, Brian.
Chapter 9, verse 2 talked about earlier, they had separated themselves from all foreigners.
All right. When God told them, when they were conquering Israel, what were they supposed to do with every nation around them? Supposedly, totally dispose them. And they did not do that. And what did those nations do to Israel? Influenced them and led them away to worship their own idols. And they were punished for it time and time and time again. And so now realizing their mistakes, they're removing themselves from the culture around them so they can be pure to God. Now, is this being standoffish? No. Is this being arrogant and self-righteous? No. But does we understand evil companion corrupts good morals? And if you want to live pure life, you cannot live with impure people because they will drag you down. They separate themselves from the people of the land so they can move to, what is, see the word to? From and to. From the peoples to what? You cannot move back to God if you don't remove yourself from the world. It's not possible. And we try to live with one foot sometimes in both. You can't. James said, he who is a friend of the world is an enemy of God. It's one or the other. And it's because, now, you say, well, how far do we go with that? What is the extreme? Jesus, in his prayer in John 17, he said this. He's praying about on the behalf of his disciples. I ask you not to take them out of the world, but you to keep them from the evil one. So does God, Jesus, expect us to leave the world entirely?
No.
You can't. That's an extreme position. You cannot be a light. You cannot be an example. You cannot share the gospel with anyone. He's not saying no contact, go be in a monastery on the hill, right? What's he wanting? Protection from the evil one. There has to be a balance in your life, how much you interact and engage in the world and how much you don't. They're not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in truth. Your word is truth. Now, look with me in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Yes, Bruce.
Question. If their family members wanted to become proselytes.
Yes.
That means they've virtually given up their own old religions and chose to be children of God.
Right.
So would that be an example of what they...
Oh, separating yourself? Yeah, if you became a proselyte Jew, that means you converted to Judaism, you would leave your other family. Yeah, largely. Right. So, look in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. It's just going to be a command and then some questions. The command is in verse 14. Do not be bound together with unbelievers. That's a command. And you say, well, what does bound mean? We could discuss it later. I just want you to hear the questions then. What partnership has righteousness and lawlessness? What fellowship has light with darkness? Or what harmony has Christ with Belial? That'd be Satan. Or what is the believer in common with the unbeliever? And if we don't say no, none, to all those questions, we don't get it. We just don't get it yet. Now, when you say partnership, fellowship, harmony, or what do you have in common, those are different degrees of association. But let's just take the last one. You got an unbeliever and you got a believer. What do they have common as far as worldviews and spiritual goals? What do they have common as about heaven and hell? What do they have? One could care less. And one, his only ambition is to please God and so he can go to heaven, right? Does that dictate how he lives his life on this earth?
Yeah.
And so one is going to say, no, my Lord says, no, I can't do that. The other one's going, what are you crazy? Let's just have fun because eat and drink, tomorrow we die. I mean, what do they have in common? You know, and I know there's various degrees of unbelievers. Some of them are more like a believer than not, but... So I'm just trying to stereotype it. That's what he's doing. So notice what he says in verse 16. What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are, as Christians, the temple of the living God. That means he lives with us. And so whoever you associate, you're taking God with you. Do you understand that? So that's why he says, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God and they shall be my people. That's what Israel's doing now. They're reconnecting with God in a covenant so God will live with them. Now here's the instruction though. This is how you're not bound. Verse 17, come out from their midst. That's the first thing. You got to what? Leave. That's what they're doing. Separating, right? Second thing, what are you to do? He says, be separate. So you are different. That's all right. You're supposed to be different. If you're not different, you're the same, and now you're in trouble. Isn't that right? You're in trouble if you're the same. And then the last thing is, do not touch. Come out, be separate, and don't touch. Wow. It says, then I'll be a father unto you. Yes.
Sexually immoral people.
Yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world, or the covetous or extortionate idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world.
You'd have to leave the world. They're all around us all.
They're around us all.
Right. Yeah. So you live among them, but you don't partner with them, is what we're saying. You be an example, you help, you love, but you do not partner with them. See the difference. Now, I want to go on, because when they say that, they said they took on the curse and the oath. What is that a reference to for all you Old Testament students? Deuteronomy chapter 27, when God made the covenant with Israel, he repeated in Deuteronomy, when they said, all the Lord has said we will do, with that came a blessing and a curse built in. If you obey God, what do you get?
Blessing.
Crops never fail. There's always rain in the spring and the fall. You have a wonderful harvest. No miscarriages. No stillbirths. Your enemies won't bother you. The blessings. Curse. The day you start serving other gods, you start partnering with them, start marrying their ladies, you're going to get famine, you're going to have stillbirth, you're going to have the crops fail, and your enemy's going to invade you. The blessing and the curse. And what are they doing right here? We accept that. We want your blessings, and we are taking an oath. We will be faithful to you, and if we're not, give us the curse. It's on us. They accept it. Now, here's my question. Do Christians operate under the same type of covenant relationship, a blessing and a curse?
Yes.
Do we?
Yes, I think you do.
Well, first of all, the blessing. John, Jesus said this, if you know these things, you're blessed if what?
If you do.
So a Christian that comes to Christ says, I believe in you, but they also say, since you're my Lord, I will obey you in everything. And Jesus promises what? Blessings. James chapter 1 says we're blessed if we do them. There's blessings on this life and the life to come. It's amazing. But is there a curse?
Yes, because he disciplines those
whom he loves.
Well, so when you fall away and you leave his grace because you choose to, then you can expect
that's right. Here's one, Ephesians 5, 6. Let no one deceive you with empty words because of these things. That's partnering with the world, immorality and all that. The wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Who's he writing that to? Christians. Christians. In Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 26 through 30, read it. If we go on sinning willfully after receiving a knowledge of truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain terrifying expectation of judgment. That's the curse. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the Lord's Supper. If we don't eat the Lord's Supper as the Lord has directed us with reverence and according to what he said, what does it say? We eat and drink damnation to ourselves. Is it important we do what he says and do it the way he says?
Yes.
Is there a blessing and a curse?
Yes.
Now, if you're following Christ and made a covenant to follow him, do you have to worry about the curse?
No.
No. You're not going to worry about it because I'm not going there. I'm going to follow Christ. I'm going to have the blessing. Yes?
How do you respond to people like even today's point of the hurricanes and the fires and all the stuff that's happening in the world? And
right.
Try to say, well, this is God judging Texas or Florida or
yeah.
California or something like that. I'm not saying it isn't, but.
I know.
What? Hey now, oh, Texas, yeah. He asked, how do you know when?
Because I'll say it's a curse.
Yeah. Does God discipline nations? Yes. Do you know when he's disciplining a nation? No. He doesn't send us memos, right? I'm serious. Is there time and chance? You know, things happen. Could he be doing it for a cause? Yes. And should you take everything seriously? Yes. And say, I don't want the curse, and make sure you stay true to your commitment, your covenant. That's the only way to answer it quickly. You don't know. Could it be? Yes. All right? Past tense, we've seen where God said, yes, I've done it. All right. Now, we're now going from the commitment to the obligations they're going to incur. Because when it says, We'll do all that you say. We'll keep it. It's going to involve their personal life, their business life, and their the house of the Lord. I'm going to say their commitment to, in us, it's going to be the family of God. Personal, business, and then the spiritual. Not that spiritual isn't really part of it all. We will not, here's the first thing, give our daughters to the people of the lands to take their daughters for our sons. That's verse 30. And this is what Brad referred to earlier, or Brian, that they were guilty of intermarrying with the heathen nations around them. And invariably, the wives who you were involved with romantically and you loved her, they would bring their idols into the marriage and they would slowly seduce their husband into worshiping that idol. It won't hurt, you know. And it turned the hearts of Israel away from God. Now we see that in Deuteronomy chapter 7, the command. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons. You should not take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, and the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you. Why were they largely in Babylon for 70 years? For this reason. That's why Ezra, in his book, we're going to see there's going to be a mass separation from their foreign wives, because they had to correct this problem. Now, whether we understand that or not, let me just say this. How does this apply to us today? Do not be bound with an unbeliever, because what do they have in common? Nothing. Be separate. Now, they had arranged marriages in their day. Should parents today who are Christians have more to say in who their children marry than is currently been practiced in our culture? When do we start guiding them about who they're going to marry? When they're young. Let me just ask this. People like to debate whether it's a sin or not to marry a non-Christian if you're a Christian. After all, we've just talked about, and we've just talked about your goals and your focus and your oath and coming out and being separate and do not be bound. How could anyone justify marrying a non-Christian if they were a believer going to heaven? How could they justify it? Are we asking for trouble? Now, I know I'll hear the story because they're here and there's God bless you. And I'm so thankful that you married a non-Christian and they became a Christian and it worked out. I will hear those stories. Let me tell you, you're the exception. You're lucky. Maybe you were strong enough that you converted, brought them to Christ. Because for your story, I can give you five others where the person fell away from the Lord. And I'm serious. It happens over and over and over again. And I ask, why would you want to? You're going that way. And even if they're a good person, they're going just that way. They're almost going the same way you are. What's going to happen with time? Are you going to get closer together or farther apart? And it happens over and over and over again. We have to take real serious who we marry. It's the biggest choice in our life, except short of submitting to Jesus. And if we want to have blessings in our marriage, we got to have all the odds in our favor. Marry a committed Christian woman or a man. Committed, not just a superficial one, a committed one. And I personally won't marry a Christian to a non-believer. They can go to justice of the peace. They can get someone else. I will not be involved in it because I don't want to set them up for failure. Because every time I have, it's not worked out well. That's just my personal choice. Yes.
In my observation too, Jack, is generally the children from that marriage do not become Christians because they say, well, dad doesn't go to church.
It's a huge problem.
Mom doesn't go to church.
It's a huge problem.
They see no reason.
Yeah. Now, with having said all that, what someone will come up later and say, well, I already married a non-believer. All right, just stay faithful. We'll encourage you. You have to stay married. We'll work, you know, God will work with you. It's fine. You can bring them to the Lord. We're talking about people that have not made the choice, right?
Right.
And I'm talking to the parents now. Talk to your kids. Talk to them. JC, talk to your kids. And I know you do. You know, talk to them. And just let them know how serious this is. It's not, America, marriage is about romance. It was not about romance back then. When you had arranged marriages, was it about romance? No, it had nothing to do with it. It was about practical arrangements and finding the right person for the right man so they can make a marriage and a family and procreate and stay faithful to the Lord. That should be what we look for. The romance will come if you follow God's principles always. It will. We got it backwards. It's all about needs, you know, personal, so narcissistic marriage. I'm not saying throw it all out, but balance it with finding a Christian mate. All right? You know what they said? They took an oath, signed it, sealed it. We will not go there. I think that should be our attitude. That should be our attitude. Turn from the foreign wise and marry where? Marry a Christian. Marry within. All right, that's my second sermon for the day. Business. As for the people, land who bring wares of grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy them from them on the Sabbath or a holy day, and we forego the crops of the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. Now, this information is given to us in Exodus chapter 13 and Exodus 30, but now they're going to, in foreign trade, they're going to turn from foreign trade to keeping the Sabbath. Here's what's going on. When you look at the Exodus and Jeremiah chapter 17, the laws about the Sabbath, were they allowed to do any business on the Saturday, the Sabbath?
No.
Is there any law that says you cannot take trade from a foreigner who's not a Jew? You don't find that. But there's an issue here. You're not supposed to do trade with another Jew, but a foreigner comes in, you can do trade with him. What are you still doing? You're doing business, even though it's a non-Jew. So the foreigners come along and say, hey, I got this great deal on some grain I just got in town. Can we finish the deal so I can go? They were doing that. And so they made a commitment, and here's where I think what we see, them going a little farther than what the law is written, said, you can't even do this now because they're so zealous not to offend and break the Sabbath ever again. So they write maybe perhaps new rules to keep them farther from it. Now, what happens when you keep writing new rules? I'm sorry? You have to write another one. So how long is a day travel? What's 7/8 a mile from home? That was their rule, 7/8 of a mile. Well, where's home? Where home is where your belongings are. That was their new rule. Well, then, if I'm traveling and I drop a piece of my clothing, is that where my possession is? And they got, well, yes. So now you can go 7/8 of a mile from there. Then if you drop another piece of clothing, you can go 7 more/8 a mile because you're traveling from home. That's how they circumvented the rules, and none of that's in Scripture. And Jesus said what? You scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, in vain do you worship me, teaching as the traditions of men the commandments of God, as precepts of God. All right? I got that all butchered. All right. But you get the point. All right? But let's go back to the intent. They're trying to honor God on the Sabbath. They haven't been. It was a day of rest. You got 6 days to work. Make all the money you want, but just stop and thank God and worship God who made it all possible. Who brought your spring rain and your fall rain? Who brought the harvest? Who protected you from your enemies? God, 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 God. Can you just stop one day and give him a little worship? And that's what he wanted. So you stop thinking it's all you and you remember who actually it comes from. That was the purpose of the Sabbath. And then also on the seventh year, they're supposed to let the lands rest. Just no planting. Now, that has some benefit, you know, just on a practical basis. But you do it because that's what God said to do it. Who's going to supply you that seventh year? God will. And then also on the seventh year, you're supposed to forgive everyone their debts. Now, that would be tough. And if someone comes to you the sixth year and says, I'm really in trouble and need to borrow some money, you do not say to them, well, this next year I got to forgive it, so I'm not lending to you. Come back at the end of the seventh year, then I'll lend it to you, because then you can have six more years or seven more years to pay it. Said, you don't do it. You lend it to them. So every seventh year, things reset. Would you be in debt for the rest of your life?
No.
Who said to do that?
God.
And they're saying, we put it down in paper, seal it. We're going to keep the Sabbath. We're going to forgive people. We're going to let the land rest. One person was talking about giving to the church. And I just really can't afford to give what I think I should, because there's not enough left over to take care of my family. So the person promised, listen, I'll make a deal. You give off the top of what you're making to the Lord. And anything you're missing during the month that you're just short, I will supply the difference. The guy said, you do that for me? I said, yes. Okay, I will do it. And he says, did you hear what you just said? You'll trust me to make up the difference if you give to the Lord? Me, a man who is nothing compared to the God who's made the heavens and the earth, who brings the rains and the sun and causes things to grow, who moves mountains and moves nations. The great God, you would trust me and you would not trust him to make up the difference? See the point? When you give, you're actually saying, God, I trust you. You gave me in the first place. I'm going to give it back to you, and I'm going to trust you're going to give me more. Because it didn't come from my hand, it came from yours.
Amen.
It changes your whole attitude when you write it down and seal it. That's what I'm going to do. None of this out of that, what leftovers. You give God out of what? The first fruits, right off the top. And that should be our attitude towards everything. Not just our giving financially, but everything we do for the Lord. Everything. And that's what they're doing right here, right? We're out of time. We'll look at that last thing, their relationship, their commitment to the house of the Lord. And notice the language. We placed ourselves under obligation. Now it's their contribution and supplying wood for the burnt offerings. And all the supplies, you know, and offering the sacrifice for their firstborn, their sons. But I just want to leave you here with this. Their tithes. They said, we're going to go back and do what we're supposed to spiritually. And so here is just some things I'll finish with you. If you want personal revival, whatever, just some things you just kind of take from this text. First, identify what areas you need to work on. Right? Pray about it. Mourn about it. Isn't that what they did? And then write them down. Did they write it down? Write it down. There's something about writing it down. It just makes it just more concrete. And then make a commitment. And when I say commitment, if it's an oath before God, and be careful, because if you make an oath, you better not break it. But you just make a commitment. And then separate. Why is that important? You cannot live for God if you're still living in the world. You can't be practicing immorality and practice purity. You know, you've got to separate. You have to make that leap, right? And then get someone to join you. Why do I say that? What did they do? They signed it what? They had all the family sign it. They had all the leaders sign it. Get someone to join you. Because there's some power in accountability, isn't there? When you're in a pack together. We're going to do this together. You can hold me accountable, and I'll hold you accountable. And then what? Just do it. Just do it. That's how we rebuild walls in our life. All right. Thank you.